with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you now my friend Clarence.
Thank you very much, Ennis. Can you all hear back there? I don't want you to miss anything. Why, this meeting here today has been billed as a meeting of reminiscence. A lot of people have been wanting to know some things about the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, how it started, and some of the things that happened. I might say that over these years there's been a good many changes in our fellowship, and I will endeavor to go into some of these things and show you just what has happened over the years and what changes have taken place. Some of them are for the good and some of them are for the no good, but with anything that has growth to it, you have to expect that. Let me start off this way. I am rather a freak in this fellowship. I've often mentioned this, that I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. And that may sound a little confusing or what have you, but here's what happened. During my drinking experience, my family, my wife and all of her brothers and sisters and mother and the whole caboodle, they finally threw me out of my own home for good. And I wound up in New York City and without a dime in my pocket and without any clothes, without anything, period. And I only knew one person in New York City, and that was another sister of my wife's. And this gal lived out in Yonkers, and I felt that Virginia would help me because I felt she owed me something. So I made my way out to Yonkers, and I remembered that where Virginia lived, I'd been there on my honeymoon, and she lived way up on top of a hill in Yonkers. And instead of getting up on that hill, I went down the hill, and I got into the Italian section down there. And this was in Prohibition days, and all Italian families made wine. And they were very sociable with their wine. Some of them sold it, and some of them gave it away to their friends. And I went down to this neighborhood, and I made friends. And by the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was quite a mess. And I can only remember a few details of this visit. I was rolling around on the floor with her two little kids. They were little babies, 3 or 4 years old, little girls. And I was drunk, and I was dirty, and I smelled bad. And Virginia took a dim view of this performance, and she put me in her car and drove me back down to New York, where her brother had thrown me out originally and left me there. I tell this story for a reason. I don't know how long I spent in New York City. It was a long time. But while this was going on, something happened. Later on, Virginia had the doctor over to her home to see about one of the kids, I guess. And they got to talking about drinking. And Virginia related the story of my visit to her home and what a nice guy I used to be and what a dirty, stinking, drunken bum I am now. And this doctor said, "That's odd, because I had a brother-in-law who was a lush, and he was always getting drunk and in trouble. And he has met some strange cult of people. And since he met these strange cults, he no longer drinks. And he runs around New York trying to fix drunks." And he says, "There's another rummy. He's a doctor, a medical doctor down in Akron, Ohio. And he belongs to this strange cult also in Akron, Ohio. And that doctor spends all of his time fixing drunks. And he says, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and meet this doctor, and maybe this doctor can fix him. We used to call it fixing. And believe me, we fixed him. It is a lot different. Today they talk about this being a program of attraction, which is the biggest bunch of hot air I have ever heard. I always just want to ask you, who wants to be attracted to a bunch of drunks? There was no attraction then. This was a terrific sales job. But what happened about this doctor in Akron? I eventually came back to Cleveland, and I didn't get in the house, but Dorothy told me about this doctor in Akron and asked me if I'd want to go down and meet him. And I told her I'd be glad to. There was nothing else I could do. I had no place else to go. So she put me in the back of her car and took me down to the bus depot, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and put me on the bus with Doc Smith's name and address in my little paw. And that's how I met my sponsor. Eventually, Doc put me in Akron City Hospital. This was long before they had St. Thomas or any of those other hospitals. He used to put his patients in Akron City Hospital. And I was in that hospital for a week. And here are the things that happened to me in that hospital. I was scared to death. I was sick. I had been drunk a long time. I was not a periodic. I was a chronic. There are two types of drunks. There's the periodic and there's the chronic. Those periodics are the birds that give us a bad name. But a fellow like me, a chronic, I'm drunk all the time. I am dependable. And I've always had some resentment toward these periodics. They really screw things up, but we don't. People know what to expect of us. Well, anyway, that's a little aside here. I landed in this hospital, and what happened was after a couple of days of shaking it out, I'd been drunk for several years. Now, this wasn't any of this drunk and sober business over several years. I was drunk these several years. And I was unemployable. I was sick. I weighed 130 pounds. And I was broke. And I didn't know where I'd be going when I left that hospital, really. Well, after I was in there a couple of days, the men who had preceded me in this fellowship into which I was about to enter came in to visit me, and they told me the stories of their life, what had happened to them through booze. None of them were sober very long at that time. Doc was sober about a year and a half. And Wilson up in New York, Bill, was sober probably a little longer than that. But the fellas in Akron, some of them were just a few weeks and a few months, and a couple of them a year. But they were all older men than I was. All of them were considerably older. I was only 35 years old when I landed in that hospital in February 1938. These men were all 45, 50, 60 years old, and they'd been through real terrific alcoholic experiences, and they told me about it. And these fellas, they just hit me right. Those fellas, I wanted to belong to that bunch. I wanted to be one of them. They were real 24-karat rummies, and they told me that they had the answer to my drinking problem. After they told me their stories. But they never told me what this answer was. And they tell me as they were leaving, they told me they had the answer to my drinking problem. And on that note, they'd make their exit. After I was in there a week, Doc used to come in every afternoon to see me and talk to me. And of all the people in that bunch, if I was afraid of anybody, it was really Doc. He had my number. I scared to death of this man. And I had a great respect for him, but he always frightened me. He frightened me the first time I ever met him, because I went down there to tell him all about my symptoms. You see, I'm a sick man. And instead of me telling him anything, he took the ball away from me and told me all about myself. And I couldn't figure this out at all. And quite a story in connection with that. And the reason I did fear him so was this. Some years ago in Cleveland, Ohio, there are people here from Cleveland. I see a couple of them here now, and they'll remember this incident. There was a incident going on in Cleveland they called the Torso Murder Mysteries. There was a hobo jungle down in Kingsbury Run. And a lot of these hobos, this was way back in Prohibition times, and people slept wherever they could. There was an awful depression on at that time. And a bunch of the drug heads used to live down there in Kingsbury Run, down there in the weeds. And they got to finding bodies down there. There were bodies found. And these bodies were all cut up, and they were dismembered, and they were wrapped in newspapers. It was a gruesome thing. But to my knowledge, recollection, there were at least 7 bodies found, and only one was ever identified through fingerprints. And the newspapers had more fun with this thing than they had with Watergate. Every time they'd find a dismembered body down there, they had headlines. And they were referring to this killer as the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. And they were trying to figure out, they figured it was either a butcher doing this or a surgeon. Because as they remarked in the paper, this fellow had a fine technique. And he knew something about anatomy. He knew how to cut things up. He did a masterful job. So he was a professional man of some kind, and they thought perhaps he was a surgeon gone wacky and getting his jollies out of doing things like that. So this thing was going on, and when I met my sponsor, Doc Smith, Dr. Bob as people call him, one of the things that after he told me all about myself, I got this blubber got working. I got thinking, holy smokes, this guy, something's wrong here somewhere. How does he know all this, see? And then the crusher came when he made the remark that he wanted to put me out in a goonie roost out here in Cuyahoga Falls where nobody could get at me. And it came through to me that I have met the Mad Butcher. He's been following me around, and now he is ready to do his little thing. And that goonie roost business where nobody could get at me killed it. Because about that time, I wanted everybody to get at me. And I waited my opportunity. I up and ran out of that man's office. He had 3 different doors I had to go through to get out. I never stopped for any elevators. I went down those 7 floors and gone. That was my first meeting of my sponsor. So you can see why I feared this man. Later on, I had to go back to see him. I had no other thing to do. I was lying around with these jugheads one day, and we got to talking about quitting drinking. I think I instituted this conversation, and I can still remember, here's what drove me into this fellowship. We come from all directions. That chap last night talking about we all come to some extremity, we come to an end. I'd come to mine, and it's proven by this one statement I can make. We were lying around there talking about quitting drinking, and this flannel-mouthed Irishman, everybody's drunk there, you want to remember. There's no sober ones around. Some of them are passed out, other ones are up and around. This Irishman, he says to me, you quit drinking? He says, you'll never quit drinking. He says, you don't have guts enough to quit drinking. He says, look at you. I says, I'm going to quit drinking. He says, you don't have guts enough. He says, you know, to quit drinking takes determination. And he says, to have determination, you need a chin. He says, you got a chin like Andy Gump. You're no damn good. Well, you know, that man goaded me to the extent that what little bit of left in me, what little spark I had left, I had to make the bet good. I says, I'm going to quit. I know a doctor Akron can fix me. He says, nobody can fix you. You're no damn good. I says, I'll show you. He says, you show me. And do you know that I got a hold of someone's telephone? I don't know whose phone, because we didn't have those facilities where we were. And Doc told me, I called him numerous times. I only remember calling him once. And he told me to meet him in City Hospital the next day in Akron, Ohio, the next morning. And I was there. And he put me in the hospital. That's how I started. Then I met these men. The day that we left the hospital, the night we left the hospital, Doc took me to a meeting of the Oxford Movement in Akron, Ohio. I didn't know what it was. I knew there was an awful lot of people there. And I saw these rummies there who had visited me in the hospital. And I knew these people, these fellas, but the rest of these people I didn't know. And there were a lot of ladies there, a lot of women. And they kind of scared me a bit. I'm glad over the years I've gotten over that. I'm making up for it. But I didn't know what I was into, and I watched the format of these meetings, and I couldn't catch on what was going on much at all. As the weeks went by, well, it finally got through to me that I belonged to the Oxford Movement. And that's where AA was born. It was in the Oxford Group. Doc Smith had been in the Oxford Group before he ever met Bill Wilson, but he never stayed sober. Bill Wilson was brought into the Oxford Movement by Ebbie Thatcher in New York at Calvary House. And that's where Bill got his start. So Bill was meeting with Oxford Group people as well. And whatever rummies he picked up along the way, they were attending Oxford Group in New York. Then something else happened. I want to show you what happens to the development of this fellowship. Something had to happen. I thought, you know, that my sponsor told me I'd have to spend the rest of my life fixing drunks. As an avocation, not a profession, as an avocation. I was supposed to go out and make my own living some way and fix drunks along the way. And first things first, the drunks were to be fixed first. I'd always, if I depended on God, I'd always find a way to eat. And this is so true. I didn't have anything to offer an employer, and I had to eat. My wife let me come back home for a while, and I was one of these unfortunate people that the marriage didn't work out after I got sober for too long. I got back home, and boy, I got busy AA-ing or chasing drunks all over the creation and spending all my time chasing them. And Dorothy had always been accustomed to being the social secretary of the family and taking care of those matters. And everyone coming to the house used to be coming looking for her. They weren't looking for me. And this situation changed when I started chasing all over, making contacts to where I could find rummies. These people were coming to the house looking for me, and some of them were pretty important people. And she just couldn't take this. She couldn't get with it. And I don't blame her, because after all, I had been drunk so long, she'd had to run everything. So finally she said to me, this is worse than when you were drinking. We better try this apart again. So she packed my little suitcase and away I went, and I never did go back. But that's just what happened. That happens to some people in this fellowship. The marriage don't work out after you're sober. But I suppose every case is different, but that was mine anyway. Well, I had to go out and fend for myself and find a place to live and something to do, and I did. I lived in a cheap boarding house down on Euclid Avenue. I paid $20 a week room and board in this boarding house, and I got two meals a day and one on Sunday. So I had a few meals I had to buy on the outside, and I had clothes to buy and other things, and on $20 a week, whatever I had left, I used to squander on women. It was some deal. But let me tell you, that boarding house had some stories to it. To talk about what happened there, I was living there, and there were probably a half a dozen other rummies living there, sober ones. And then there was a lot of other people. There were about 35 people living there. We used to always eat together in the basement. We had a big table in the basement. That was the kitchen and the dining room combined. So we ate at certain hours there, certain hours for breakfast, certain hours for supper. And if we were good and we didn't start any fires in the place or anything like that, every once in a while the old Irish landlady would let us bring a guest to dinner. It would cost us 50 cents to do that. I tell you this for another reason. I invited a guest one night. I was going with a gal, and I wanted her to come over sometime to this boarding house and meet some of these inmates and see where I was living and how I was living and all about it. And
lay out for a little while and rest. I'd walking down the drugstore, I guess, to get something, and here comes Catherine down the street. And Catherine is so drunk she can't hit the ground with her hat. So Catherine's been out to the Warrensville workhouse so many times that she was serving a life sentence on the installment plan. And she knew every brick on the way out there. And I grab a hold of Catherine and says, "Catherine, let's get out of here. Get off this street. You're going to get picked up. You'll be back there at Warrensville again." "Okay." So I start taking her home. She lived a couple blocks away from me. Lived over in Cedar Avenue. Bad section then. But Catherine decided before she went home she wanted something to eat. Well, she made a big hullabaloo about this. You'd have to know Catherine to know why I cave in and give in to her. She was very persuasive. She had language that the likes of which I've never heard any place. I think Catherine used to teach sailors how to swear. In fact, I think she made up words. She was something else, no kidding. And she was young. She's in her early 30s at the time. And she's skinny as a match. And so Catherine wants something to eat. So I try to take her into this Greek joint on 81st and Euclid there. And she looks at me and she says, "I wouldn't go in a dump like that. I want a place with a tablecloth. I'm used to eating like a lady." There you are, a lady. She's so drunk she can't find her mouth. Well, she's raising a lot of hell, and I want to get her off the street. So to humor her, I made my first big mistake. I took her down the street to 79th and Euclid, where that nice spaghetti house is down there, that Italian restaurant. And all the business and professional people around there eat there at noon, and it's a quiet place. They have a carpet on the floor and tablecloths and male waiters with tuxedos. And as soon as I brought Catherine in there, I knew that I had done the wrong thing. Because she is dirty, she stinks, she's loud, and she is profane. And we go over and sit down at this table, and she right away has a tete-a-tete with the waiter. They're having trouble already. And she's telling him a few things about his ancestors. So everyone can hear it, you know, the whole people, and people are stopping, looking over there. And the next thing you know, she orders spaghetti. Well, she has about as much chance of eating that spaghetti as I have flying to the moon, see? But the spaghetti came. And in the meantime, the head waiter had come around and tried to shush her, and she don't like him at all. I think she had something against this rule of authority. And this fellow, this head waiter, he was authority in her book. So she told him a few things, too, that she hadn't told this other guy. Well, she's still making an awful fuss and racket, and she starts working on this spaghetti. Coming up here, and she's got it all over. Get it on her. She don't get it in her. It's all over. And it's dropping back down in the plate. And this waiter, this head waiter, come back again, and he was giving her the word real good. And she'd had enough of him. She wanted no more of this guy at all. She'd gone her limit with him. So this little gal didn't do anything but pick up this plate of spaghetti and throw it all over this head waiter, right down his dickie. Well, it was about 2 minutes the wagon was there. And Catherine and I are both in the wagon. We get down to that police station, and they put me in one coupe over here, and they took her someplace else. And I'm rattling those bars and telling them I don't belong here. This is a mistake. And the guy said, no, no one belongs here. This place is full of mistakes. So I get this treatment. I'm getting no place. And I guess at 3 o'clock they change shifts. And another bunch of keepers come in about that time. And I start my rattling situation all over again. And one guy finally listened to me. I says, you call Crowley, the probation officer. Ed will tell you all about me, and he'll tell you that I don't belong here. The guy says, you know Crowley? I said, yes, call him, for God's sake. Get me out of this place. And he did, and Crowley thought this was great. This was the funniest thing ever happened to him. But he got me out, but they kept Catherine. And they sent her out to the slammer again. And I didn't see anything of Catherine for some time, till one day I'm home again walking down the drugstore. I should stay out of that drugstore. And here comes Catherine again. If anything, she's worse shape than she was the first time I saw her. She just got out of the coop and she's all drunk up again. So I said, Catherine, you'll be back in Lawrenceville by this afternoon. Let's get off the street. Let's go home. But I said, Catherine, we don't eat today. So, okay. So we got to 82nd and Euclid. As you know, there's a Jewish temple on one corner and a Unitarian church on the other here. There's a traffic light there. So I thought I'd cross at the traffic light. I didn't want to risk trying to get her across the street where there wasn't any light because she was pretty unsteady. So we get to this light and we're waiting for the light to change. And here's high noon and all these business people are all heading for their lunch again. The street's full of people. And Catherine feels the call of nature. And she don't do one damn thing but squat right there on 82nd and Euclid. And I'm standing there holding her by the hand. This is something to be said for sponsorship. Well, don't you know, some of these interested passers-by stopped and they looked and they had a few words and she had some words for them too. And don't you know, it wasn't another minute or so till our wagon's there again. Right back to 21st and Central is right. Away we went. Well, indecent exposure, oh, I don't know what all they had, but they had us, see. And intoxication, of course, they assumed that I'm in the same shape. Why would I be with her? And back I go. Start all that stuff all over again. Crawley had to get me out the second time. He thought this was really rich that time. This was entertainment by now. I didn't think it was so funny. I do now, but it's looking back on it. But you know, what we do to that girl, between Mooney, Miss Mooney, and Crawley and myself, we arranged to put her in Warrensville for a year. Put her in jail for one solid year. A year and a day she got as a habitual. Now that's taking a lot of for granted when you take their freedom away for a year. I told them that the only way we're ever going to do anything with Catherine is she's going to have to get completely reorganized. We're going to have to get her well and sober and get some meat on her bones and everything else. So she couldn't, I didn't see how they could do anything but give her a year. And they did. Took her out there for a year. Well, of course, I didn't dare go out and see her right then because she knew I had a hand in this, but I knew she'd send for me eventually, which she did. So when I went out, she sent for me. I knew the matron out there, and she called me and said, Catherine wants to see me. I went down to the dime store, and I bought her some little stink water the girls like in a dime store. And I bought her some cigarettes and a little candy and stuff like that. I spent about 60 cents on this broad. This is really plunging, and I had it all in a bag. So I went out to Warrensville to see her, and I'm sure glad they had that screen up out there. Because when I came in there, boy, I heard something. The air was blue. And the only thing I'd do is stand there a little. She got through. Eventually, she ran out of gas, and all she wants to do is get out of there. I told her, Catherine, you're not getting out of here. You've got a year and a day, and you're going to be here all that time. So make up your mind to it. That's the end of it. You're going to be here. They put her in the hospital out there. I can assume that Catherine had everything from dandruff to fallen arches with the kind of a life she was living and the things that she was exposed to. So they kept her in the hospital. They started building her up. She started getting some fat on her bones. After she quit hollering at me that day, I gave her my bag of goodies, and she accepted them. I went out to see Catherine every week, sometimes two, three times, sometimes twice a week I'd go see her. But she quit yapping about getting out after a while. She resigned herself to it. When she came out of there a year later, Miss Mooney took her out of that neighborhood and got her a room with some old people way out by Yucca Beach Park. And these are some Slovenian people. They knew nothing about AA, never heard of, knew nothing about drunks. And she went to work she went out there to live, and I tried to bring her to a meeting, and they threw her out. The women would not accept her in an AA meeting. And so she couldn't go to AA. But I took her to some picnics and things where we had a big bunch of people, and she didn't have any identity. But she couldn't get into the AA way of doing things. But she did one thing very important. She went back to her church. She was a Catholic. And she went back into her church. She hadn't been there for a long time. And she was interested in working with kids. And she was very good at working with kids. When we come out of there, Mooney got her a job in one of the hotels. First on a bathing beach as a lifeguard. She could swim like a fish. When the bathing beach closed in the fall, Mooney got her in a hotel as a floor clerk. And Catherine went back to school and started getting a refresher course on her typing and shorthand and things like that. And don't you know, she finally got a job as a stenographer. She became a private secretary. She wouldn't spend a dime to see the original crucifixion. She's the tightest babe I ever saw in my life. She saved all her money. These are stories. I'm going to write a book on a lot of these people. They're terrific stories of what happened to their lives. I have notes here of an awful lot of them here I could mention here, but it'd take too long. I don't have the time. But I just wanted to give you an idea how things were in what they call the good old days. Those good old days weren't all good. There was a lot of problems and a lot of things we had to overcome. There were some tragic things happened in those days, too. The hospitals wouldn't take people, and I had one fellow die on account of that. They thought he was drunk, and he wasn't. He'd been hauled into one of these hospitals on numerous occasions before, and the East Cleveland police called me one day and told me they had this fellow in their garage. They left him lay on the floor of their paddy wagon. They'd picked him up on the street. He was unconscious. They took him to the hospital, and the hospital people there recognized him as a drunk. And they said, he's drunk, we get him the hell out of here, so take him back to jail. The police didn't put him in jail. They knew something was wrong with this fellow. So they called me, and I went out and took him over to the post shaker. And the man had a cerebral hemorrhage. But because of his history of being a rummy, going into this place, in this emergency room, they wouldn't take him, and he died. If they'd have known about this cerebral hemorrhage, maybe they could have done some massaging or something and maybe saved his life. This is one of the tragedies. I've seen a lot of tragedy in those days, but there's a lot of great stuff, too. So you have to take the bitter with the sweet. I've had people commit suicide right in my face in this thing, right there in that boarding house, too. Oh, brother, I don't want to talk about those things, but those things happen, but you look at the great things that have happened. The thousands of people who have been affected by this and the wonderful things that have happened in their lives. I had one of the greatest things happen to me just this last November. A great thing. I was invited back up to Cleveland to speak at the anniversary of two groups. They were having their 35th anniversary, 35 years, these two groups, the group on the west side and the Borton group. I spoke at one Monday night and one the other. And I see some of these people still alive, over 35 years sober. Great. Then we look out and see all those hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of newer ones that have come in. Because these other people did stay. It's really something. But I like to think about those things that happened rather than some of the dismal things. But we all had a great time. The advantages we had in those good old days is with everybody, just about everyone was broke. And we had no televisions to compete with our meetings. We had no money to buy season football games or baseball games. We had no activity except ourselves. We stuck together. Our fellowship there was tremendous. We all knew where everybody was all the time, and we worked together, and we never worried about the hours or how many or what we had to do. We did it. This is the way those people did, all of them, all of them. I don't single out any single one of them for any virtues. They all had them. But it was great. We had nothing else to do. That's the way we put in our time. We didn't have clubs, as you notice, as you see clubs today. We used to meet in hospitals where we sponsored people. You go out, you're lonesome to see somebody, you go out to a dryout hospital or a rest home where we had patients, and you could visit all the rummies you wanted. There were plenty of patients there to talk to and plenty of other people there. Always some place to go. Our time was filled working with one another. And this was our life. And I think people miss an awful lot of that today. But it's still available. And you and I are the most fortunate people in the world. I say this for this reason. for many centuries there was the alcoholic had no solution to his problem. This has been going on as long as time has been recorded. Up until the last few years, the last 30-some years, now there is a solution for the alcoholic, and you and I have been able to be invited into it. You and I have this opportunity. Millions and millions of people never had this opportunity. You and I have. It's great. I have lived most of this century. I was born in 1902. I've mentioned this before. I've seen some great things happen in this century. I saw the beginning of the automobile industry. There were very few cars when I was a kid. I saw the beginning of radio. Saw the beginning of television. I saw a man sent to the moon. I've seen all these great things happen. The atom busted. I've seen this. All these wonderful things. And finally we come to this solution to the alcoholic's problem. This is the greatest thing of the whole bunch. I say this is the greatest thing that's happened in the 20th century. And you and I, we have a stake in this, and we have a responsibility in it. And you and I are the people who are going to carry it on. And we can't carry it on unless we believe in what this stands for. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a booze cure. You heard very well last night what it was. This is a way of life. And you and I are fortunate enough to have been introduced to this and have the opportunity of serving in it. We don't need a lot of organization. We just need love. That's it. Thank you.